I'm going to call the meeting to order. Good morning, everyone. We don't have a quorum yet, so we'll dispense on the approval of minutes. But my name is Paul Gardner. I'm a representative from Shoreview, District 53A, and representing communities in suburban Ramsey and Anoka County. We have a lot of interesting deep science for all us lay people who will eventually be coming in. On the issue of drinking water, the purpose of today's hearing is really to get a good survey of what the science is related to drinking water in the state. There's some pretty standard stuff, and then there's some pretty cutting edge stuff that I think will help give us an idea of where we're at. We would have one more hearing before the session starts. We don't have a date for it yet, in January, where we'd like to do talk to some of the municipal governments that usually are the responsible units for drinking water for their communities, who have had to deal with contamination and the like, mostly here in the outer ring suburbs in the Twin Cities Metro. And I'd like to hear from them just to see what experiences they had to go through and what challenges they face as it relates to state policy. So that would be my goal before the session, and then we're going to have a regular time slot after February 12th. I can't remember if we decided what it is yet. There's a lot of things going on, as you know. So that, for the stakeholders out there, I just wanted to let you know. I'd invite you to the table, but people were coming later, so I don't want to mess anything up. As I said, we'll wait on the minutes. We'll let whoever the presenter is, when we get a quorum, I'll let them finish, and then we'll just do the minutes. First up, we have Jeffrey Thielen from, Celine from USGS. Come on down and fire away. But yeah, seeing the rookie chair, I'm told that you must sign in the login sheet so that we know that you're here, but you can wait till after you're done.
All right.
Or we'll stick people on you. If you could give us your name and organization for the tape, that will help as well.
All right.
We can get the rest of that later, too, if you want.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Celine. I'm with U.S. Geological Survey. I'm a research hydrologist. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before the committee today. I have probably about 10 minutes worth of slides and information on groundwater recharge research that we've been doing recently at the USGS, and with my colleagues at the DNR as well. And feel free to ask questions at any time, or if you'd prefer to hold them till the end, that's fine as well. And I thought I'd begin by talking about what we know about recharge first. This is a block diagram. It's included in the fact sheet that I believe I got a copy of to all of you. There's a glossy copy and then a black and white copy as well. This is an introductory fact sheet that Jan Paltzak and I at the DNR put together. It's just kind of as a primer on water recharge.
Yeah, we could get that.
Okay, great.
Previously, great. No, that was very helpful.
And what this illustrates is kind of a conceptualized flow system in rural Minnesota. Glaciers covered the space about 12,000 years ago, and it depicts aquifers. Typically, there's surficial sand and gravel that's laid down in certain areas, and those form aquifers, which is a water-bearing deposit. It can be either sand and gravel or sandstone, limestone, that contains water in its pores and is allowed to readily be pumped by wells. That's kind of the basic definition of groundwater or an aquifer. And beneath this surficial aquifer is a confining layer, this gray area there, that's composed of finer grain material that doesn't transmit water as readily. It can be composed of silt or clay or in bedrock situations, shale typically. And that doesn't allow water to move through it very readily, but it confines the deeper aquifers that might be below it. So what we're seeing here is that precipitation falls at land surface. A portion of that runs off to our surface water bodies, streams, rivers, lakes, wetlands. Some of that water is taken up by plankton and transpired to the atmosphere. Other parts of the hydrologic cycle there is the evaporation of water off of the surface water bodies. And what's left after that is allowed to infiltrate into the ground. And that portion of the water that reaches the water table is what we call recharge, groundwater recharge. And water then moves away from the water table towards the stream. So recharge occurs in most areas of the landscape, but at varying rates. And for example, in low-lying areas, such as this area shown here, runoff over the landscape will gather in the depressional areas and increase the recharge locally there, as opposed to surrounding areas. Another example would be for impervious surfaces. Water can't get into those cave areas, for example, so it runs off. Or if you have silty, clay material at land surface, water can't infiltrate as readily there either. So recharge rates are varying from location to location. And most recharge water moves relatively rapidly to surface water bodies, as depicted by these flow lines here. The groundwater discharging to these streams sustains them in times of low flow, base flow we call it. And you can, if you recall, during even extended periods of drought, some of the smaller streams might go dry, but the larger rivers, Mississippi being a noted example, still has water in it, and that's base flow from groundwater. It's really groundwater that you're seeing the effects of there. Let me define a few things that groundwater recharge is not. Sometimes it's confused with other terms. One of those is infiltration, and this is a term that really refers only to that movement of water from land surface into the subsurface, into the unsaturated material that doesn't have water filling all of the pores. However, part of that water, large part of that water, is returned to the atmosphere through evapotranspiration and also through evaporation. And it's only that portion that reaches the water table that is called groundwater recharge. Aquifer yield is another term that's sometimes confused with recharge. And this is referring to removal of water through pumping only. It's just the ability of an aquifer to pull water out of an aquifer, but it's not equivalent to recharge. It could be more than or less than the actual recharge rate. And sustainable yield is another term that commonly is misused, equated to recharge, but this is a separate issue altogether, relating to management decisions, value judgments that are put on by water managers, and the recharge rate could be greater than or less than any sustainable yield that is assigned by a water manager. Okay, another process that is discussed in the same light as recharge is what we call leakage, and this is for the deeper aquifers, the confined aquifers that are below these confining units, this gray layer here. The the leakage rate, we call that leakage rather than recharge. It's not totally incorrect to call it recharge, but a more technically accurate term would be leakage. Those rates are much less than to a superficial aquifer, to the water table up here. So we need to know more about recharge, groundwater recharge. We know even less about leakage rates to these confined aquifers. There's much to know or to be learned about that. The water can't move as readily through these confining units composed of clay, silt, shale, what have you. And that's very important in southeastern Minnesota. For example, the Twin Cities area, where we have a series of confined aquifers, which are shown on the diagrams here. This is a cross-section through the Twin Cities area. These blue formations here are the aquifers that supply water to many of the municipalities in the Twin Cities area and indeed southeastern Minnesota. And they are confined largely by bedrock, shale, siltstones that reduce the amount of water replenishing those aquifers, and we need to know more about those leakage rates. The of course, Minneapolis and St. Paul obtains most of our water from the Mississippi River, but most of the suburbs receive their water from these aquifers. And the three main ones that we obtain our water from are highlighted in red here: the Jordan, typically combined with the Prairie du Chien Jordan aquifer, the Ironton Galesville, sometimes combined with the Franconia, and then the deepest one is the Mount Simon Hinckley. Of course, pumping costs are greater the deeper you go, and I believe Jim Jaff will be talking about that a little bit later. And so the main thing I wanted to point out here is that there is bedrock confinement, which reduces our recharge rate, our leakage rate, and that affects the water availability. So groundwater recharge is a critical in virtually all groundwater-related issues. I've listed a few of them here. Groundwater movement, we typically learn more about that with groundwater flow models. It's a good tool. We use it as a tool to learn more about groundwater flow systems. And recharge is the one variable in these groundwater models that we know the least about, but to which the groundwater models are most heavily dependent and reliable on, sensitive to. Wellhead protection is another issue where groundwater recharge is very important. Groundwater surface water interaction, as I mentioned, groundwater sustains the base flows of streams. Recharge is very important there. Effects of urbanization, water quality and contaminant transport, aquifer vulnerability to contamination, and then of course water resource management issues such as water balance estimates, resource allocations, purviews of the DNR, and I believe Jan Paltzak will be talking about those issues when she speaks later on here. And my colleague Dave Lorenz and I at USG has recently completed a research study which we published in a couple of journal articles. And the map that you see here of spatial variability of recharge across the state of Minnesota was published in one of those journal articles, and it was then republished in this fact sheet that you each have a copy of here. And this is we feel, a good starting point for looking at differences in recharge across the state of Minnesota. And it was based on climate data, precipitation mainly, stream flow, soils, natural transpiration information, and without going into too much detail here, you can see correlations with precipitation, where precipitation is lowest in the western part of the state. We have lower recharge rates, and as we move further to the east, as precipitation increases, we see increasing recharge. So it's a very good correlation there. Similarly, with the soils in the Red River Valley in northwestern Minnesota, we have siltier clay materials, and our recharge rates are lower there, which you would expect. And then in the central part of the state, we have sand plain aquifers, which are very permeable, allow that water to recharge readily. So recharge rates are a little bit greater there as well. The NOCA sand plain is highlighted in red here because that's the largest sand plain in the state of Minnesota. And we call this the regional regression recharge, or RRR, model for reference. Even though this map just came out this year. We're finding this quite heavily used and referenced already. And one thing we're trying to caution is not to use it on a local scale. It's much more of a regional tool for water managers to use. In other words, we're cautioning that someone in a local community not pick it up and look at the recharge rate and say, my recharge rate is 6 inches per year, whatever it says on the map. It might be, and we hope that it's pretty close, but we need more detailed information at the local scale to really get an accurate estimate of recharge locally. We feel that it is valuable for regional analyses, however, and is a good starting point for input for groundwater flow models. So what do we need to know then about recharge? We need to have a better understanding of how recharge varies spatially and in time, particularly at the local scale. And what we need to accomplish that would really be high-quality, long-term, continuous hydrologic data. And what I mean there primarily is groundwater level data. We're highly deficient in high-quality data measured. This recent research we did indicated that weekly measurements at least are necessary for accurate measurement of recharge. And with the data loggers that we have today, it's really easy to make measurements as frequently as one wants. At least daily, I think, is helpful. And then, as I mentioned, leakage rates to confined aquifers are poorly known. So that portion of the recharge and hydrologic cycle, we could learn a lot more about. And then finally, groundwater models are needed for drought preparation and to track changes in groundwater storage, as well as to evaluate potential effects of climate change on water resources in the state. And these can be accomplished through regional studies to evaluate the effects of not only these factors, but also competing water interests, such as when we have municipal water needs competing with industries such as ethanol production, which is increasing across the state, and other aquatic or local effects as well. So I'll just conclude here with one slide that kind of summarizes the types of data needs that we need improvement on locally at the groundwater levels, stream flow, climate data, and high-quality data measured frequently to increase our knowledge of groundwater recharge from the past. Are there any questions? I'd be glad to try to answer.
Representative Virginia.
Thank you. Are there areas of the state where we have this good recharge data? I mean, we have the wells and the monitoring. Are there places where we have it and places where we don't, or do we need it statewide?
In terms of the high-quality data?
Yes.
We do have a limited number of wells. USGS maintains a network of about 20 wells, maybe a little bit more than that, across the state. But it's a pretty big state, so 20 wells doesn't go very far. And if you recall back to the cross-section of the Twin Cities area there, we have multiple aquifers. So within the Twin Cities area in particular, we have a need for, we had one well monitoring water level thing that Jordan at this location, it would be nice to have multiple wells in the Jordan, but then we're also in need of measurements in the other aquifers. So particularly in the Twin Cities area, we need these types of data. And the we do have some measurements in, like, municipal wells, quite a few measurements of municipal wells, but these aren't adequate because they are affected by the pumping. And we want to have natural background conditions that aren't affected by pumping.
Representative Virginia.
Can I follow up on this? If we were to have the system that you wanted in the metropolitan area, I mean, how many wells would, just give me some sort of ballpark here of how many wells you'd be thinking about?
Well, the more the better, of course. But
right, so something that's reasonable that would give you enough data to know perhaps where you really need to concentrate more or not. I mean, it's the gold star and then the B+. I'd go for the B.
Okay. I don't know. We're talking about coming up with a proposal, a tag line at the USGS to really quantify that and then work with the DNR to develop this network. There's been a recognized need for it for years.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the actual number, I hesitate to throw a number out because then it'll probably get ingrained in people's brains. But, 20 to 40, maybe, something like that.
In
the metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, aside from trying to figure out how many is a good number, finding adequate wells to monitor is a big problem. We'd mainly have to, I think, install new wells.
Mm-hmm.
Existing wells would be hard to find. So there'd be cost for drilling the wells if we couldn't find a suitable well, and then the instrumentation equipment, we feel that we can get those installed and in place for as little as like $2,000 per year. That would include the equipment cost plus monitoring for an indefinite period of time.
Could I have one more follow-up, please?
Representative Virginia.
Yes, I understand DNR jurisdiction, and I'm also thinking of Metropolitan Council's jurisdiction. Have they talked about, I mean, they did testify before this group in the last hearing, and I don't recall talking about needing to install monitoring wells, and I just may have missed it. But have you worked with them on that, or is this just something with DNR?
We have spoken. Chris Elverum is here today, and we have talked about the need, and I believe they are interested
mm-hmm.
and see the value in monitoring, long-term monitoring. And I think local communities are also interested and should be, benefit from this type of a network. So I think the next step, after we get this framework, this colleague of mine at USGS and I think it's probably a good idea to get together all of the interested parties and discuss how we can best achieve the goal.
One more? I have a lot of competition here for questions, Representative.
Okay,
go ahead.
Last one. Is there federal money available, or would there just be state money for this?
There would be federal money. Typically, we match up to 50% of any state or local dollars. So that's a competitive process, however, and we can't guarantee that money will be available at any one given year. But yes, there are federal dollars available.
Thank you.
Okay.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, my pleasure. I have a question, too, about the issue of the confined layers. You know, this is my little handy-dandy report notebook with all this stuff I've been brushing up on. And there was one of your colleagues at the group, I guess you're in Moundsview, had done a paper on recharge, and I just started looking at the numbers, and it says, you know, in confined layers, the recharge rate can be, and that was, you know, 0.00000.
Very low.
Something. Well, okay, in my community, for example, in the north suburbs, we have groundwater, get our municipal water supply from the Prairie du Chien Aquifer, which, from understanding, is a confined aquifer, and the recharge rate is fairly small, and I don't know how they calculate how much is coming out on an, you know, inch depth basis, but this is the thing that has really perked my ears up as I go through this material, is that we don't really know what this blob of water is like in terms of volume. And if we, you know, have a high capacity well, you know, gravity sort of pushes other stuff in that layer towards that well, I guess, and you know, we just don't know what the volume is. We don't know what the three-dimensional picture is. I think we're moving in that direction, but I just find that we don't seem to know what we don't know. And I guess I'm happy that you guys are studying to find out what we don't know. You know, should we be a little bit edgy about the sustainability of taking from groundwater for municipal water from confined aquifers at this point? Or when should we start to sweat, 20 years, 50 years, or is it just fine?
Sustainability is a key issue that the DNR, I think, is grappling with. We can certainly calculate the volume of water, and then that's kind of a static thing. If we have the porosity and the volume of material, you can actually calculate the volume of water. But it's the release of that water when you turn the pumps on, and the sustainability of that that's in question. And I'll defer to Jan, when I think she's probably better qualified to answer actual sustainability issues associated with that. But I think the more data that we have on the hydraulic properties of these confining units, the more better prepared we'll be to answer the sustainability question. And that just takes funding. And I think there's, for 20 years now, the MGS, DNR, USGS, University of Minnesota, we've been periodically revisiting this and discussing how best to fund a study like that. And it really just boils down to funding. We need to, we have the interest, the scientific interest, but we need the funds to proceed forward.
Just out of curiosity, what would that figure be in round numbers, and how often?
Boy, here we go again.
Hundreds of thousands, millions?
Probably be hundreds of thousands over a several-year period. And the type of testing we would be doing would be collecting cores, or maybe analyzing cores that are already stored by the MGS, doing hydraulic tests on them, doing pumping tests, installing wells, and running these tests on the formation. One of the tests we run are called Packer tests, determine hydraulic properties to better evaluate how fast that water moves through, how readily it allows the water to get down to the Jordan or the Great Basin that we need to get our water from.
Okay. I had this plopped on the desk, the synoptic measurement of groundwater levels.
Mm-hmm.
Does that come from your office then?
Our office and the DNR.
Okay. Well, it says project proposal, so I don't know if it's actually been submitted somewhere or it's in process or...
It's in process. I think Dan will be talking a little bit about that.
Okay. You're with the DNR, is that right? Okay, so maybe we can wait on that a little bit. Okay. Great. Any other questions? Great, I appreciate it. One thing I find is that when you set up a subcommittee, sometimes data just emerges out of the, you know, for us lay people, it just comes out of the woodwork, and we find out there's a lot of good work going on, and we need to be able to digest it and figure out what it all means. So.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to...
Representative Clark, you're not getting away yet. Hold on.
And I apologize, Mr. Chairman, I just got here, so I missed this testimony. I was trying to catch up by reading some of this stuff, but... And maybe this isn't the subject of this particular testifier or even most of the hearing, but in addition to the actual volume and so on of the recharge, is this an appropriate time at all, or are we in some other places talking about some of the problems with contamination in those waters that come in terms of, has that been...
We didn't touch on contamination issues this morning, and there are... I guess there are two other, one subcommittee and one working group that Representative Schumper and Representative Bunn are working on in specifics, but it would seem to me that contamination and the issue of sustainability fit hand in hand, because stuff can end up in plumes that goes other places. So if you had a question, fire.
Well, I was just thinking of some of what we heard when we were down in Rushford, and some of what's turning up in the wells there after the flood. I mean, they're not, the water isn't clean, and where it's running through, the kinds of geology that's there, the strata of the rocks and so on. I'm just wondering if it seems like these issues should be kind of connected, or perhaps you are looking at that in some ways or not, or in terms of, you know, the actual capacity of water, that's the sustainability of the water that's available. Contamination is going to play a big issue if people are not able to use their wells, even when they supposedly pass some sort of time of cleanup.
You're absolutely right. They're very interrelated, and I don't know if you were here when I put this slide up, but the point of this slide was to indicate that groundwater recharge is critical on virtually all groundwater-related issues, including this groundwater contamination that you're referring to in southeastern Minnesota. In southeastern Minnesota, it's got another problem superimposed on the difficulties we have in other parts of the state, and that the rock formations there have a lot of fractures and solution channels or gaps in it, which we call karst features, and that's what largely contributes to this contamination or increased contamination in those areas. So we are working, we and our colleagues at the DNR, the University of Minnesota, Calvin Alexander does a lot of tracer test studies down in the southeastern part of the state and others. And it's an area of great needed research as well to learn more about how these contaminants and the water move through those formations. Now, USGS has done recently a source water protection study, and this was centered in the, it was part of our Upper Mississippi NAQUA study, National Water Quality Assessment Study. And the report is just about ready to come out, but one of the major conclusions of that study was that monitoring for pesticides in the source water, which is the main thing that we did there, is a good indicator of the occurrence of pesticides in the finished product. Ooh, what happened there?
Of course, man.
There you go. So, yes, that's a very important factor, and it's definitely something that we are looking at, both the USGS and our colleagues in other agencies as well. The health department, as I mentioned, of course, they're very interested and involved in these studies. We're actually doing a study with the health department looking at ways to evaluate wellhead protection areas in this karstic area of southeastern Minnesota, because that's very challenging when you have these solution channels that are not following the strict rules, if you will, that would be prevalent in, say, the Twin Cities area. It makes it much more challenging to predict where the wellhead protection area would be around the well.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Are you going to stick around?
I will be here.
Okay, so just in case. Mr. Setterholm is not here yet. We think he'll be here after 11, but we're going to move up the folks from the U, if they could come up. Going to do a little plugging in here. If I'm not mistaken, what we're going to hear now is part of a proposal submitted to the LCCMR. Oh, ready to roll?
Yep.
Oh, great. Usually it takes longer to plug and play. Could you state your names and organizations for the record, please?
Yep. This is Sangwon Su. I'm an assistant professor at the Department of Bioproduct and Biosystems Engineering at the U.
This is Ewan Chu. I'm from the University of Minnesota, a water resource science. I'm currently a PhD student.
And my name is Laura Smith-Olovici. I'm a postdoctoral researcher with the Ecosystem Science and Sustainability Initiative at the University of Minnesota.
Right ahead.
So we are here to
to talk about the proposal that we have submitted to LCCMR. LCCMR panel members have recommended for supporting this proposal, and we are waiting for final approval. The proposal is about the Minnesota's water resources and current status and the future trends. Whenever we talk about the water resources availability in Minnesota, then we face the question like, well, isn't water abundant in Minnesota? We are a state of 10,000 lakes, so what is the problem with water? I think that kind of view lacks the insight that inherently the water resource is a very local resource. So unlike crude oil, where it can be transported in long distance, for water, long-distance transportation of bulk water is economically very infeasible in many cases, and there are also institutional barriers for transporting water from one region to another. So Minnesota as a whole may have a water surplus, but still some regions may suffer from water deficiency. And we believe that there are some trends, some new trends, that will shape the future water resources of Minnesota quite differently from before. So those new trends that we are focusing on are three of them there. One is bioethanol and agriculture, and the other one is demographic changes and climate change. I will elaborate a little bit one by one. The first one, bioethanol industry in Minnesota. This map shows the current locations of bioethanol industries in upper Midwest region. As we can see, most of the biorefineries are located in the southwestern part of Minnesota. And this graph shows the trend of ethanol production and expected future trends in ethanol production. And there was a standing mandate on the ethanol production by 2022, where it should be about 35 billion gallons per year of production of ethanol in the United States. And currently, in Minnesota, we are producing about 550 million gallons of ethanol per year. And by 2008, it is expected to be doubled. By the way, this blue bar shows the ethanol production in Minnesota. And by 2020, again, it will be quadrupled to make it 4 billion gallons per year of capacity will be contained in the state of Minnesota. What is the problem with this, the production volume, expected production volume of ethanol in Minnesota is that currently about 3 to 4 gallons of water is required in order to produce 1 gallon of ethanol only by the refinery facility itself, if we are using corn starch-based ethanol. The problem gets worse if we are using cellulosic ethanol. By the way, cellulosic ethanol is a new type of ethanol production, and actually standing mandate recommends using more of cellulosic ethanol as compared to the corn starch-based ethanol. By the way, this green bar shows cellulosic ethanol, and as you can see, it will sharply increase by the time 2016 and on, while the corn starch-based ethanol is expected to plateau around 2014. So the cellulosic ethanol, the current expectation is that per gallon of ethanol, it will require somewhere around 6 to 9 gallons of water per gallon of ethanol production. So by 2020, it should mean that, well, this much of water will be needed in order to support biorefineries that produce cellulosic ethanol. But this is only about biorefineries. If we're thinking about the irrigation water, and water needed for irrigation, per gallon of ethanol, it is expected to require about 785 gallons of water if it is irrigated. And currently, we are not using much of irrigation for corn, but, well, as we expand our corn production to the land where there are needs for irrigation, probably this will be the case. The second trend that we are looking at is population growth. And population growth does not take place homogeneously throughout the entire state. It's very spatially, it has really the spatial preference in going about the population growth. So population growth is not only about increase in household water use, because it also requires development in the new land, and then new development will induce increase in impervious surface, and of course it will induce higher runoff rates. So things are connected with each other, and we are looking at those issues. So this map shows the what state demographers project the population growth rate between 2005 and 2030. As we can see, there are regions like this here, upper metropolitan ring and southern metropolitan ring and the Big Lake regions. There will be very high population growth over the next 30 years or so. So apparently the impervious surface will increase around these regions, and also runoff will increase, as well as the household water withdrawal will also increase as well. And last, the climate change. The impact of climate change, well, the relationship between the climate change and the water, is both cause and effect at the same time. The higher temperature will increase the evapotranspiration rate. At the same time, higher evapotranspiration means that, global warming effect will be actually accelerated. By the way, the water vapor is the most important greenhouse gas that we know of. At the same time, we can expect that the more rainfall will happen, but it will be take place in the form of intensification of the precipitation, which will increase the runoff rate. Does not really help much of the groundwater recharge. And also there are more complicated mechanisms like increased the formation of cloud will reflect back the sunlight, so that it will decelerate climate change. So the effect is much more complicated, but we are trying to detect some of the effects thereof. So our approach is really combining the scenario development and water balance and GIS mapping, and combining those three components to project the water sustainability of Minnesota, given those trends that we have reviewed. So, for the scenario development, we teamed with Dr. Laura Schmidt, who is working for the Ecosystem Science and Sustainability Initiative, and she has been developing a series of scenarios for other LCCMR projects. And UN2 is a water resources science PhD student. She has been working on water balance and water budget mapping that she will be talking about. So probably Dr. Laura Schmidt, can you talk a little bit about the scenarios part?
Sure. So in approaching the scenario development that we're looking at to see what might happen with state resources into the year 2050, we're taking a really unique approach of combining kind of scientific analysis with some projects working with stakeholders around the state that are talking about trends that they see in their local resources and what they think will happen to their resources by 2050 and their communities by 2050. So we're trying to have that kind of dialogue going on. And it's still in the process of coming together, but I just wanted to show you some of the trends that we're seeing in water consumption to go along with the groundwater balance and the water supply issues that we've been talking about. So it's probably no surprise that water consumption in Minnesota is growing as the population grows. But from the USGS data represented here, we can see that from 1950 to today, the water consumption per capita for municipal water is also growing. So Minnesota citizens are using more water than they did. By far, the largest category of water withdrawal in Minnesota is for power generation, mainly for steam cooling of coal and nuclear plants. This data comes from the DNR's water permitting database. The municipal and local waterworks are the second largest category, and industrial uses comes next. And as you can see, crop irrigation at the top is a fairly small percentage of overall water use. However, it's one of the fastest growing.
Can I ask you to back up for a second to the previous slide? Mm-hmm. When we're talking about water withdrawal, are you talking about groundwater, or are you talking also about surface water also?
It's everything together. Yeah, everything that needs to be permitted.
I didn't think we were doing a lot of water withdrawals for power generation cooling.
Yes.
Mostly rivers. Yeah.
This includes surface water, as you point out. Right. And it's also important to point out that not all of this is consumptive use. However, it's a complicated analysis to determine exactly what we mean by consumptive use, because even if something is withdrawn and then returned, it might be altered in quality or in temperature, and it might be returned to a place that is spatially different from where it was taken out.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Representative
Clark. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, on the previous slide, this one, I believe, there's a dip in 1995. Not this one, the next one. Yeah. What was the? How do you account for the dip there in the early 90s?
I'm not sure. I wasn't here in Minnesota at that time. Maybe someone else is more knowledgeable than me about that. One thing that we are, if you break it down by trend, you can see that, interestingly, the industrial water use is becoming more intense per dollar of GDP produced or GST produced in Minnesota, but water use for agricultural irrigation is actually becoming more efficient, and that's the one category where it is becoming more efficient. So, as I mentioned before, growth in water withdrawals by sector is highest in the industrial and in the crop irrigation categories. So when we talk about water use, I think we need to consider the way that current trends are going and how that might evolve in the future, as well as the way it is today. And that's what we're hoping to do with our scenarios, to look at the consequences of some of these things that are going on in the state and how they might play out over the next several decades.
Okay. I have talked about this before, so this, and I will turn this on to water balance part.
And thanks to the great efforts of USGS and DNR, and actually many valuable data sets are available out there, and they've made all the data sets very accessible to the public. So now we are taking a very simplified water balance approaches to study this specific topic. And as you can see, if we take an entire Minnesota as the unique boundary here, and all the precipitation falls into Minnesota, and then it turns into all the become vapors and clouds in the atmosphere, and then part of them become overflow runoff and make flow out of Minnesota. And also, If we take the very simple by the mass balance, we can see that the precipitation actually can be broken down into evapotranspiration, runoff, and then the rest of them will be the dynamics of our land surface and groundwater storage. And the interesting is that actually most of the precipitation falls in Minnesota will be, of course, the major part will go back to the atmosphere through evapotranspiration, but due to the nature of our landscapes and the stream routings, and actually we don't really get much water through the surface runoff from our neighbor states. And actually we provide most of the runoff to our neighbors in the other way. So here we take several map layers that's available from USGS and also the DNR, and we put them together and try to figure out what's the current condition of our water balance within Minnesota.
By the way, those maps are, for instance, precipitation, which is an input to the water balance to the Minnesota, and evapotranspiration, which is an output to the water balance of Minnesota, and some of them are water runoff, etc. So that combining those different GIS layers, we can actually calculate geographically where are the regions of water deficiency and what are the regions of water abundance.
Yeah. So from the right-hand side map, from the green one, actually you can see it's a very low, the water balance actually is a localized issue due to the natural condition of overall Minnesota, and also the landscape and the land cover, you know, vegetation types, and also of course the uneven precipitation with overall Minnesota. And what we are interested in, and these maps, maybe some of you are very familiar with these. You can see these, you know, from the USGS or and DNR website, and it's about the precipitation within our Minnesota.
and also our runoffs. We can get this kind of data through DNR, and they have a very long-term monitoring, and also USGS. And this is a groundwater withdrawal that we combined with the previous presentation and from the USGS. And you can see at the metro area, we actually have a very significant withdrawal annually. And but we are interested in right now is that if we put all these input and output together, what's the balance condition within Minnesota? And you can see a deeper red colors around the metro area and also the northeast corner. And at the northeast corner is particularly due to the greater runoff, annual runoff. But of course, at the metro area, it's due to the great consumption. And with all the little dots, like the blue dots and green dots, actually those are ethanol plants within Minnesota right now. And some of them are currently existing already, and some of them are under construction. And what we are interested in is that if we continually to have all these plants within these regions, and by understanding the water balance and comparing with the future possibility of the water consumption rate, what will happen? What will happen to, you know, Minnesota's future? So here we put together how much water balance can be affected by our daily consumption. And of course, again, along the metro area, that's the significant area that's under this kind of impact. But also, we should be more careful at the central area, which actually matches with the previous slide, if you still remember, that we will possibly have a higher population growth rate in the future. So, taking all these factors into account, we try to shape what's the future balance condition within Minnesota. And hopefully, if we continue this kind of approach and we try out several, we compare different kinds of models associated with, you know, hydrology and evapotranspiration, also climate models. And we hopefully we can put all this together and come up with a better approach. And of course, a finer resolution and a better outcome of this kind of study.
Well, we will stop there, and if there is any questions, then we will be glad to answer. Representative Wiggins. I want to give you a chance.
Thank you. I'm thinking about your talk about runoff out of Minnesota. So I was just checking some of my assumptions here. You're talking about water running into the Mississippi and the Minnesota River and then going downstream, and that is water lost to us. We're not receiving from the Dakotas or Wisconsin. So that is water lost to us. So if we were to up our consumption of water, we would be in better shape if we upped our consumption of that water that is leaving. Am I getting that right?
Well, I think you're right. So if we're using those water, then of course the runoff rate will be decreased. As we increase the withdrawal from the surface water, then water runoff rate will be decreased. That is interlinked, yes, it is. Yep.
Representative Virginia, so you're talking about like a reservoir situation where we ought to retain stuff that's leaving the state? Is that what you mean?
Well, I actually am thinking about how we place industry. If we had industry using river waters rather than groundwater, we would probably be better off because, I mean, that's what I'm just gleaning from this mass balance, which is fascinating, and I'm so glad you all are doing it. But it just seems to me that since we don't know much about our groundwater, we don't know the rate at which we're using it. The conservative thing to do would be to use more river water that we're losing anyway for
industrial, or, and I'm in Minneapolis, we use that for our drinking water purposes. So expensive, but if Minneapolis were to go into the aquifer, nobody would have any drinking water. I mean, we know, so that's kind of the model I'm thinking about. And I'm just checking, and you're shaking your head that that may be, I'm making some decent assumptions here, and that's what I'm trying to figure out.
I think from the Minnesotan perspective, that is for sure right. So for instance, we can think about, well, withdrawing all the river water and spraying it throughout Minnesota, especially for those areas where soil characteristics allow us to the higher groundwater recharge, and that will be beneficial for groundwater perspective for Minnesota. But I don't know how neighboring state will think about that.
Minnesota likes to spray.
Yeah. I do very well understand that.
Representative Pinkleton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think with Representative Wagenius' comment, it's important that everybody should be nice to your neighbors upstream from you, so I'm going to keep that in mind. I just have a couple of quick questions. When Dr. Sue started out by talking about this as an LCCMR project, I appreciate that. Just wanted to give you the status. In the package that the LCCMR is looking at, we've recommended 35 projects out of, there was more than 100 that were submitted. And so 35 projects for a total allocation of about $23 million. And that will be moving through the legislative process this spring. And I know for this project to make it through all the different hearings and stuff, it's kind of testament to the high quality of this and the need for this project. So I appreciate what you're doing. A question then is, was it just yesterday that Congress passed the energy bill with talk of more use of biodiesel and corn-related projects for energy? I'm just wondering, with your analysis and kind of the stepped-up demand we're going to see in the next few years, will you be able to incorporate some of that information into your project that you're doing concerning water?
Certainly. We are looking not only into the autonomous growth of ethanol, but also we are looking into the legislative changes and the feedstock changes and technology development, all those kinds of different issues. So we are not developing one pathway for the future, but we are generating multiples of different scenarios and to see the, what are the pathways that we are heading to. Do you have any other comments?
No, just that is correct, that we are using current legislation and also proposed legislation to look at some of those different scenario pathways.
Great, thank you.
The thing that I found intriguing about this is that it's a little deeper than some of the EQB stuff we heard about at the last meeting, which was good. It sort of was a good way to approach the issue, but this you know, the kind of layering of the different data is going to be helpful. I'm curious what you think you would find with climate change. That's going to be one of the things that we're going to discuss in great detail in the House in the upcoming session. And I, you know, there's, but we're not going to end up like that movie, what is it, The Day After Tomorrow or something like that. We're all drowning, you know, in the Statue of Liberty under 200 feet of water. That's a bit much, but we're also told that we should maybe anticipate that the summers would be more like Kansas and the winters more like Wisconsin, and that's about the best estimation right now of what we think it might be. Do you think some of the data you would have would sort of give you an idea of what mass you're talking about of water? Is that going to change? Would we be more arid? Would we be more dry? Or wet, rather.
We actually haven't actually started the bulk of work on the climate change part, so what I can talk about now is purely my guesstimation. Of course, the climate change will affect on both ways. So on the one hand, it will increase the precipitation, for sure. However, the increase of precipitation will occur not throughout the year, but it will be occurring for very specific, very short small, very narrow windows of time, so which means that precipitation will occur by intensification of precipitation. When the precipitation is intensified, it does not really help for groundwater recharge, because most of them will run up throughout the river network. So addition of water through the intensification of precipitation, I believe that is not very much helpful for providing more water surplus in Minnesota. However, the negative part, which is evapotranspiration, will occur more homogeneously than precipitation. So if we think about the water balancing, of course, input will be increased by water intensification, but also outputs like water runoff will dramatically increase, and at the same time, the evapotranspiration will increase. So overall picture, I believe, is that it is adverse impact. We will be more drier in the course of climate change. That is pure my guesstimation.
Anything to add to that?
Well, you know, one thought that occurs to me, and again, I'm not a specialist in this area, but just reading enough of it, it seems that some of the water availability as we withdraw from confined aquifers means that some of the water that eventually comes out and evaporates or runs off is lost to us, and there's minimal recharge to those confined layers. So even though there might be a certain balance or equilibrium, a certain amount of water there isn't going to be accessible, and it's happening at a rate that is faster than, you know, the way nature evolves over thousands and millions of years. So I don't know what to make of it, but does that sound accurate? We're taking some usable water out of the system.
I'm fully in line with what your thought is.
Okay. This guy gets straight answers. He sticks up to the legislature all the time. very good. Any other questions? Welcome, Senator Rummel. She's my favorite senator. She's my senator. Very good. Thank you very much. And we look forward to seeing how this progresses through the LCCMR. We tend to address that fairly early in the session. And we're excited by a lot of the information and new ways to look at the data. Thank you very much.
It was our pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't see Jill still at her home yet.
Yeah.
So perhaps we could go straight to the DNR. We asked if you could talk a little bit about water pricing, sustainability, and regional assessment. Sorry? I'll have to let these... someone can track down a computer, I think, for you.
Mr. Chairman,
this could work too if you.
Yeah, we can do this fast.
Okay. Let's not hold you up. Let's just let's use some of the technology we got. Say, Dennis, I think we can just use the overhead thing. He's got 8.5 by 11 sheets, and then we've got copies. Does that work for everybody?
Mr. Chairman, there are packets with all this information for
right.
The members. There were handouts there, so I think you can deal with this just with the document. So.
That would be fine.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Kent Lockhart, I'm the Director of the Division of Water. And I thought we would, if we start to talk about maybe the synoptic measurements that we're doing, and it's something that the GS had a handout on, and they're still here, they can address some of that. And Dan Falterstek is here that's probably managing this and can explain the details. Basically, what this is just a snapshot of water levels in the metropolitan area. And it's something that we should be doing on a recurring basis, and we are, although the schedule has lagged. The last time was in 1990, and we should be doing this every 10 years instead of now it's gone to about 17 or 18, because we're going to be doing it in the in the summer of 08, and this gives you an idea of the levels, and you have a measurement so you know actual fact. This is much more valuable than running any model and hypothesizing about what might happen. This is actually going to show what might happen.
Hi, I'm Dan Faldeseth for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. My pleasure to speak with you today about this current project that the DNR and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Met Council are currently jointly proceeding with. Last winter, the USGS came to the DNR at one of our periodic coordination meetings and said, oh, did you know that we haven't done one of these metro-wide measurements in a while? And we weren't aware that it had been so long. And we thought that that was a very good idea to proceed with, and that has proceeded this year. The USGS had some money to put into the project, and the three state agencies participated for the state match. This coming year, with this joint group of people and agencies, we will be measuring water levels in the metro area in March and in August. There will be measured about 250 or 300 wells in a very short period of time, about 2 weeks. So we get, like I say, a snapshot. The map on the right of your handout shows the sites that were measured for the 1990 measurement. And they were pretty well distributed throughout the metro area. The coming measurements will measure water levels in three major water supply aquifers: the Fraser Stain Aquifer, the Franconia Ironton Galesville, which has not been measured in the past, and the Mount Simon Hinckley. Previous measurements in 1990 and 1980 have these results. In 1990, in the decade from 1980 to 1990, the groundwater withdrawals increased dramatically. In that 1990 measurement, they noted that the aquifers supplied 75% and 7% of the groundwater withdrawals in the metro area. Over that decade, the median or the average water levels in the Prairie du Chien and the Mount Simon aquifers declined by an average of 2 feet in the Prairie du Chien and 43 feet in the Mount Simon Hinckley. And that was primarily from the increase in pumpage. At that time, in the 1990 report, they anticipated further decline. And so this current measurement will see if that prediction carried out. The previous measurement in 1980 had slightly different results. From 1971 to 1980, they noticed that the water withdrawals in the Prairie du Chien were relatively stable, but had decreased in the Mount Simon Hinckley. At that time, in 1980, the Prairie du Chien supplied about 80% of the groundwater withdrawal, and the Mount Simon Hinckley supplied about 10% of the groundwater withdrawal. Over that decade, 1971 to 1980, the average water level measurements in the Prairie du Chien changed less than 5 feet. But the water levels in the Mount Simon Hinckley rose more than an average of more than 10 feet. And this observed change was primarily attributed to changes in pumping, there was less or more, and climate. The kind of output that results that we will be seeing as a result of this uh, 2008 measurement will be something like this. This is a change map from 1971 to 1980.
And this is for the Prairie-Saint Aquifer. Prairie-Saint Jordan Aquifer. Okay? The gray area shows the extent of the Prairie-Saint Aquifer. It's not everywhere, as you see. The area that has the little cross marks on it shows where the water level increased more than 5 feet. And the area where there's a horizontal dash showed there was a decrease of more than 5. But overall, there wasn't much more than 5 or 10. It was pretty stable. And that was because the water withdrawals were fairly stable. Another aquifer that we will be measuring this coming year is the Mount Simon-Hinckley. And this is a change map that shows the change from 1971 to 1980. In this case, because of the change primarily in the water withdrawal during that period, you'll see that most of this area has an area marked with those little crosshairs, cross marks that indicates an overall increase in water levels. Historically, the Mount Simon-Hinckley still has depressed water levels from historical before developing conditions. But here you can see the response in the system from changes in pumping. And so for this next year, we'll do those measurements, and then we're producing similar kinds of maps to show what's happening in the current situation. And we expect that before 2009. We did provide a copy of the project proposal, and it's not really a proposal because it's been funded and it's ongoing, and we will be done with it in 2009. The measurements will be this year, and the report will be the following year.
Would it be correct to say that one reason that there was a decline in pumping in the Mount Simon-Hinckley is because the legislature banned new withdrawals? Isn't that that's in statute, right?
There were a variety of reasons, and that can be that was written up in the report that accompanied those change maps.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it was there was a change in meat packing production. So St. Paul changed, and there were other reasons why there was a decline in pumping in the Mount Simon.
I know we said no stockyards in New Brighton anymore.
Yeah.
Representative Clark.
I think that are some real basic questions. I don't think I understand all of the language and the implications. On this schematic here where it shows the aquifers.
Yep.
If what we're seeing is that the Mount Simon-Hinckley is the deepest of the aquifers,
yep.
is that correct?
That's correct.
And each of the other ones, as we go up, the St. Peter is the most shallow.
Mm-hmm.
However, that's in the Twin Cities area, it looks like. And then as you move out of the Twin Cities area, am I correct to say the Mount Simon-Hinckley rises up higher?
Yes.
And then does it ever reach ground level somewhere?
It actually does.
Where is that?
In like Pine County.
Okay, so...
Or it might be covered with a thin layer of glacial sediment.
Okay. So, if we're looking at the Twin Cities metro area, which is what you were measuring here, we're concerned about... It looks like we're concerned about each of these aquifers, but you told us, I think, that you're measuring the deepest one. The deepest one, Mount Simon-Hinckley, has the biggest loss of volume. Is that right? 10 as compared to 5, I think I saw. Is that right? Is it volume we're talking
about? Representative Clark, the water levels have declined in the Mount Simon.
Mm-hmm.
That's from historical pumping. The aquifer is still there, but the water levels, because of the pressure, have declined.
That's what I'm referring to, the volume of the water. Is that what we're talking about? The amount?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark.
Mr. Larkin.
The through the metro area, the Mount Simon is you know, it could be 1,000 feet deep. I mean, it's a very deep aquifer. It's finished a well into the Mount Simon, and it's under pressure, it's an artesian. And so the water level rises significantly in that well. So you don't have a pump that's 1,000 feet deep. Your pump might only be 300 feet deep. You're talking about a decline in that, in the measurement that you're measuring in that well. So you're not down to the top of the aquifer and seeing a decline in water levels that are within, contained within that aquifer. But you have a confining layer above it that's keeping the water in that aquifer. Once you punch a hole in that, the water level tends to try to equalize, and it rises in that in the well. So you're seeing, when you're seeing the 43-foot decline, that's what was in those depths that you're measuring in the well.
Mm-hmm.
There is a reduction in volume with any water withdrawn from the system. But these are systems that are recharged, and you see, and that's what we hope to find out with doing this synoptic measurement in 2008, how does it compare to the past? There are changes in pumping, our water levels, they rise and fall in these aquifers based on use, based on climate. If you have, I think you noticed in one of those other charts, there was a dip in the levels in the 90s. It was very wet in the early 90s. 93, we had floods in the South Pacific State for most of the year. So it's those kinds of things impact the water levels and impact water use.
Representative Clark.
I feel like I need some basic geology lessons again or something. So one thing. Does the water...
The book's right here. Somebody...
Okay. Does the water, the hydrology of the water in these aquifers, do they exchange? In other words, you were telling me that the deepest aquifer could pass water up to a higher aquifer. Is that what I heard you say?
Mr. Largesman.
Mr. Chairman. No, I said you have finished well. That's, so it's only open to the Mount Sinai, for example. You wouldn't have that well open to the other aquifers. That's not allowed under current well construction code. But it's under pressure, so the water level rises in that, in that drilled well.
Mr. Chairman, but you might have to go through one aquifer to get to the other one. But you're saying if the aquifer is located 1,000 feet deep, you only have to go 300 feet. How does that get you down to the...
No. Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, you have the well with each field through these other aquifers. You might drill through the the Jordan aquifer, and that's the field. There's no water transferring from the Mount or from the Jordan into your well. You finish it all the way down to the deepest aquifer, and then the water level rises into your well column.
I guess I misunderstood you. I thought you said something about 300 feet versus 1,000 feet.
Well, it could rise that far up into the into that well.
Mr. Lucas, would an analogy be like you're punching a bag full of liquid with a gel and the or with a needle and the stuff just the pressure manages to push it up a certain amount, and that's actually where you pump it. Okay.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think so. But so you would still, I guess, Mr. Chairman, you would have to go down the 1,000 feet to get there. It's just that you're saying where the water starts to flow out is at a higher level.
You have to pump it from 300 feet. You don't have to put it because enough pressure has pushed it all the way up that high.
That's right. That's why, establishing monitoring wells into these deeper aquifers are so expensive because you have to drill 1,000 feet deep. It could cost you $100,000 to put in them all time and observation.
Well, let me ask a question that's kind of on my mind. I guess I'd like somebody to come to my office and just go over some of the hydrology. That would be good. So, I don't know, maybe any other legislators have this issue, but here's a question. I know in my district we had this big arsenic plume that went down into the aquifers. It was from a pesticide plant a few blocks from my house, actually, and we got arsenic all over our yards, and they've taken off several hundred, and they're going to do several hundred more, I think 500 and some more yards that they're taking off because there's so much pollution from the arsenic. One of the concerns that's been raised by the community is the plume went down into the aquifer and it's moving towards the Mississippi, is what we're told, very, 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 very slowly. Nevertheless, it is moving. I'm confused, like, which aquifer are we, am I thinking about, are we talking about, are we being informed about that's being polluted with the arsenic? And, you know, I mean, if it's, can you answer that question? Maybe you can. Maybe somebody else could help us answer that. But I do know that we've asked those questions to try to understand.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. And obviously, you know, it's going to be polluting the shallow aquifer first, and whether or not, and what the plan is to, you know, sometimes Timbers Park, I mean, they have an ongoing well that's creating a drawdown so they can collect the Riley Tar, so they can collect the pollutants and manage it that way. What's happening on this one for the arsenic, I'm not sure if that's the EPA.
I know, Mr. Chairman, I know that it was cleaned to some extent, but it's not all coming out. And I guess I'm trying to understand here who all, a little inner city neighborhood that's concerned, everybody, if it's in the aquifer, a lot more people should be concerned, and I'm just trying to understand, mm-hmm. you know, how to make those connections.
Maybe we can track down the right person. I certainly learned from an hour discussion with the well drilling folks that the importance of dealing with abandoned wells, which can actually eventually become conduits for contamination from the surface down to the aquifers, and they can show you all sorts of stuff they found in wells that were improperly sealed. Any other questions? Representative Wagenius, and then Representative Singlestead, and then Senator Rummel, do you have questions here?
Yes. You mentioned that the mountain in Hinckley comes close to the surface, I think, in Pine City.
In Pine County, yeah,
of course, yes, yes.
What steps are you taking to ensure that the aquifer doesn't get polluted in that county because it's close to the surface?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cavinius, in that county, Pine County is one of the counties that we have done a county atlas project in, and we have created maps that show the potential pollution sensitivity in that county, including the near-surface system and some buried aquifers. The counties can use that information to modify their local land management ordinances and protect that land from the very beginning.
But this aquifer belongs to all of us, mm-hmm. and maybe Pine County chooses for political reasons not to do that. Mm-hmm. What is your responsibility then? And I would add, just thinking of the sealed wells, for example, I mean, the unsealed abandoned wells in Pine County, which might be a source. What steps are you guys taking to make sure that aquifer is not polluted because it's so close to the surface there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, for unsealed wells, we've had a project to seal all of the unused wells on state land, and we've completed that. So that's done, and there's a requirement in law that any abandoned wells have to be sealed. So that part of it, I believe, is done. And it's create an awareness with the atlas and the sensitivity to create an awareness with local government on the types of activities that they should be looking at in those areas. It's not an area where you want to put a landfill. If you have, and I know, you know, counties have used the atlas results to help them cite certain types of activities. What exactly Pine County is doing, I'm not sure, but the whole process is to create awareness of the issue. We don't have any direct regulatory authority.
Representative Virginia.
That's troubling to me. I mean, Pine County, then you're saying they have the responsibility, and the water belongs to all of us in a whole bunch of other counties where we can use it. But one county, if they don't do their job, well, too bad, the aquifer's polluted. That's the way it goes, guys. I mean, that's what I'm hearing, and I hope that's not the message you're giving me. So let me put it a different way. Have we checked to make sure? I know you all have sealed all the state wells and that abandoned wells, and that's a good deal. Mm-hmm. Are all the abandoned wells in Pine County sealed?
Mr. Lagasmore.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eugenia, I don't know, we'd have to check with the health department, but I presume that that virtually all are still, certainly all the ones on state land are. The, because that we have direct responsibility over. That would be a health department question, and then we can ask them.
I think that would be important for us to know. I mean, these are all with practical problems for practical solutions, and it seems to me that practically we could know in this area where the water could be vulnerable, are all the abandoned well sealed? Or that's it. I mean, we've known about this issue for a long, long time. So, but that, okay, we take aside that. But what's beyond just saying, well, see, Pine County, this is a, we want to be sensitive. What's beyond that is the responsibility of the state to protect drinking water sources.
Mr. Chair, Senator Virginia,
Senator Chester.
I'm sorry,
Representative. That's not a problem. I'm very happy to be a representative.
The health department, in the development of their source water protection mapping and their wellhead protection work, used the output map and all the other data created by the Atlas program. In the development of those protected areas, wellhead management areas, that protects those wells. And of course, your comment is, what about the larger picture? I do know that some counties have adopted local ordinances, what they call environmental overlay districts, where it restricts certain kinds of development or certain intensities of development. In certain areas. Olmsted County has adopted such a district. Clay County has adopted such a district, and other counties have also moved forward with these environmental overlay districts, some of which is, you know, directly reference the pollution sensitivity maps that have been created.
Since we don't have a direct answer to the question, I'm thinking a couple of things. We heard from what I think of as the MOP county in your last hearing, and that was Dakota County, but it's been just a period ago. I think perhaps we need to talk to have the health department come in and say what they're doing so we get a sense of what is really happening. And from a practical point of view, I mean, it's a practical problem. What's practically happening out there? And I think we need to also talk about the state's responsibility when one county jurisdiction may or may not be doing its job. And then do we just say, well, to that, or what is it that we do as a state to protect drinking water, which would be available to folks in many, many counties? Am I articulating a question that concerns other folks as much as it concerns me?
Well, Representative Guinness, if I maybe you can restate what you're saying is maybe we're not recognizing the interrelations of drinking water supplies from one community, one county to another, and we ought to recognize that somehow and make sure that all responsible units know that their actions have an effect on others. Is that the direction you're going?
That's part of the direction, but it does seem to me when water flows underground and can move from county to county, you can't just say, I mean, we don't put up little barriers around the county and say, that's not the way water acts. So to say that it's totally county responsibility just doesn't make a lot of common sense to me.
So you're looking at ways that the state can help ensure that integration of information, decision making, and so on.
And if my memory serves, states like the city of New York has
protects their drinking water sources way upriver, way up in the mountains. And, well, why aren't we doing the same thing? I mean, that's kind of the second piece. So I'm sharing my concerns. I'd like to hear if other folks have the same concerns.
You had mentioned wells, too. In talking to the well driller folks, they reminded me of a statute that I think if you sell a property, you have to disclose the presence of a well. You don't have to say what condition it's in, but I've discovered in my own community in North Oaks where about 90% of the houses have well water, that in some of the earlier homes there's no well logs or anything. You don't even know where it's plugged in. So I think, would it be fair to say that sometimes we find surprises that there are wells that we didn't know were there, that Joe and his brother Bob drilled back in 1938, and nobody knows about something like that. So sometimes we want to know where they are, but we don't always know that they're there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius raises a good point. And another example of that would be the city of Moorhead. And they now are using surface water, but they used to use a buffalo aquifer that's just out of town, east of town. But that's in the county. And that aquifer is actually exposed to the surface, so they have gravel pits that are directly connected to the aquifer. So they're very concerned about the type of land use that goes in or around that. Yet it's still on the freeway, which goes right through it. You can contaminate their alternative source of water. So there are issues on how you deal with across jurisdictions on protecting water supply. So it's a good point for us.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay. Then maybe it would be helpful if DNR would make some proposals to us about how we should be dealing with that kind of situation where aquifers run under more than one county or more than one jurisdiction, and in that case it's the same county but two jurisdictions. We can see from earlier testimony the drinking water is vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we need to be thinking thinking a little bit more about source protection. And
we'll talk with the health department then.
That would be helpful, I think.
One thing I'm finding as I plow through this is that sometimes we don't recognize the interconnections because we don't have the data, and you know, it's been interesting to find out what we do and don't know.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark, I had a few, but go ahead.
I know, but just to this particular point, in addition to the health department, it seems like we ought to ask the Department of Ag because they're responsible for anything that goes with pesticides. That's what we learned, you know, in our community, and trying to understand if the wells, even in Minneapolis, were closed. It was the Department of Ag. So you could just add that, the health department and the Department of Ag.
Well, unfortunately, I have not had a very pleasant history in dealing with drinking water. I guess I will think about the metropolitan area for this minute. But let DNR, who really does have responsibility for water and the quantity, let's see what kind of ideas they can come up with.
Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. The first one relates to this project that you're going to be working on. You said that the report is due in 2009. I'm just wondering if you have an exact date. I mean, will we have time to hear this at the legislature and act on it in the 2009 session? Is it January 2009 or June of 2009? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tinglestad. On page 8 of the project proposal is the work plan. And the report, part of the work plan, the reports are due in fall. Let's see.
Fall calendar 2008, but early 2009 in the federal fiscal calendar.
Okay. I was getting mixed up between the state fiscal year, calendar years, and federal fiscal years.
So it sounds like, yes, it'll be ready before the 2009 session.
That'd be great. It'd be very helpful. Then my next question, Mr. Chair.
Singlestead.
I had a lot of interest in the information that you presented about the decades and how the water changes in the aquifers have happened through the decades. I think that's really valuable information to kind of show where things are progressing. And certainly there's a heightened awareness right now of water quantity issues around the country. You know, I've spoken to legislators in Georgia where they've had, you know, almost emergency situations in the Atlanta area with drinking water. So I don't know if there's any obvious answer, but I guess the billion-dollar question is, when will we run out of water? Let's hear the answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative said, the answer to the question is how you manage your resource. And if there's a severe change in our replenishment, say precipitation changes or something like that, then we would have to make a decision about how that water is managed. Someone might not get as much as they need to. We may all have to impose stricter conservation limits. It's a matter of responding to those changes by making management changes.
Mr. Lockesmore, you have some thoughts.
The legislature years ago protected the Mount Sinai Hinkley and eliminated some uses from that, so that's kind of the savings account for water. But you have to, for the Jordan, it's a dynamic system. The Jordan Aquifer discharges into the Mississippi River, it discharges into the Minnesota River, so it's not something that water sits down there and isn't moving through the system. So it is, as Dan said, something that we have to manage and we have to monitor. That's the reason for the study, is to see where we are and see if there's any red flags and things that we should change how we manage.
And can we get that information quickly enough to act on it in a timely manner?
We will get it as soon as possible. I mean, it's a process, and we're doing it cooperatively with the USGS. They have a federal process for review of their studies and documents, and we have to, certainly respect that process, too, and get a final report that is usable, and we will try to get it as quick as possible.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Jeff, Assistant Director, Division of Water, Representative Pinkle said, we also have an existing network of 750 observation wells, so we're not relying solely on this. This is just to give us a good snapshot of the Twin Cities area, so it's not like we're waiting for this to happen to make any management decisions. We do that, with every permit we issue and every condition that exists out there that needs to be addressed.
Let's see, I have a lengthy queue here. Senator, welcome, and do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. In our district, as Representative Gardner told you, we have some well issues, and the constituents are asking us if the water in one of the aquifers is contaminated, and the solution is to drill down to a further aquifer. Will the contamination be pulled down to the lower aquifer? In other words, does water from one aquifer have the ability to move down to another or up?
And there's some more detail. I think the contamination is in the St. Peter, and the potential new well location would be in the Prairie du Chien Aquifer. So it's a confined aquifer, I guess.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, in that case, those aquifers are relatively connected. And if you put a strip by pumping on the lower aquifer, water will move to it. If you put a strip by some pumping on an upper aquifer, the water can move upward into the overlying aquifer also. Maybe Thrall, if there's a scale unit or something that separates it. But it's the stress from pumping or that causes the water to move. There's a natural flow system, of course, where it's moving outward and moving to the Mississippi and the Minnesota from higher areas of higher pressure to lower pressure. But you can impose pressure, you can impose stresses by pumping and change that natural flow. It can move up or down to respond to that stress.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, a follow-up question?
So then, we do know we have pollutants in a number of our aquifers. Is all of that moving toward our rivers, and is there nothing we can do about that?
Ms. Chair, in response to your question, I had worked at the Minnesota Fish Control Agency in the unit that responded to Superfund sites, including large ones. And the way to respond to large pollutant plumes is to impose a stress and pump it out, or you put in a barrier to protect it from moving further. And there are ways to design those systems to keep the plume under control and to capture it as desired and remove the contaminant. It's a very slow, long, involved process, but it's done in a variety of places.
Let's see, Representative Clark, I had you down, or did you get your question in?
I did, thank you.
And Representative Lugenius.
Thank you. I just want to follow up on something that Representative Pingle said. I mean, she asked the fundamental question about will we have water? And the answer was, well, if we manage it right. However, here's what troubles me. At the last hearing, and I don't think you were there, we had folks from Metropolitan Council, and they testified to us that they were doing some planning, and or the way they were looking at planning was to plan for the year 2050. That continues to trouble me because they're not planning for the lives of a child born today, much less some of the folks who are sitting around this table or in the audience. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people alive in 2060 that have been already born. I mean, it's just the planning to, I'm not comforted by anybody saying if we manage, if our planning horizon is 2050. It's just, it's not only, it's very discomforting because that is a lousy planning horizon, to put it mildly. So that, I just had to let her know. So that was the Georgia problem. They didn't have a planning horizon. And if we're going to have a planning horizon, it's got to be better than that.
We don't have a finite planning horizon, Mr. Chairman, Representative Virginia. We're looking for sustainable water supply into the future, indeterminate future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Virginia,
just
to clarify some of that, too, the planning horizon that Council is looking at in part takes infrastructure into consideration and the use expansion and things like that that are going to cause impacts on water supply. But that doesn't mean that they're just looking at 2050 as their horizon for water supply. They're working with us on how do we sustain this resource long term. So I think there might have been some misinterpretation there as far as the planning horizon on that. We're not looking at just the design life of a pipe or a water treatment plant or anything like that. So the horizon is long term.
Is it to this point, Representative Virginia? Okay.
Oh, I'm going to just push back a little on that. Because at the same testimony, the testifier said he was scared to talk about some of the issues involved because of the pressure from local governments. And so I know what that kind of pressure is, and we need to have our grasp in the summertime. And if we can't even talk about these things, I'm still not comforted that we can manage.
Representative Clark,
do
you have a question?
Yeah, I remembered one of the things I was wondering about. First is a comment, though. I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Jan Falzacek.
You described the cleanup of a plume, contamination plume down into an aquifer, and I know more about it than I wish I knew in terms of what happened in our neighborhood. And because the EPA did come in and try to clean up the plume that's of arsenic, and maybe, I don't know if you were there at any of the time that was happening,
my understanding is they did a pretty good job, but you can only do so much, and there's still contamination that moves through down, you know, that's going. It's there, and even though it's moving slowly. The comfort we were offered by the folks from Planet of Ag and the Pollution Control Agency and EPA around this whole issue as well, there's certain kinds of particles in the aquifer that kind of slows it down a bit, and that's good, and I don't remember the exact details of what they were called, but it is nevertheless an imperfect system. You can't clean up that kind of, in this case, extreme poison. Arsenic is one of the most potent poisons there is. You just can't get it all out. So just wanted to say that. I mean, I don't want to be over comforted by the efforts that were made, even though they were, I think, excellent, you know, within our limits. The other question, though, was there's this issue of, and our senator asked it too, of water moving back and forth between the different aquifers. I just wonder about if there's a mapping done that shows, we have just a little snapshot here of the levels of the aquifers in the Twin Cities area. Okay. So in order for people in Pine County to care about this, or in order for us to care on our own behalf about what happens in Pine County or any other place in the whole state, are there maps that have been made that show how these aquifers go up and down, and is there a way for us to actually start to, you know, really understand how we are interrelated? I think you know, your point is, you know, that there is this interrelationship, but, you know, if we sit here and we don't know this, we don't know why one of our legislators in one area should be concerned about something happening in another area, we won't be able to have that interrelated connection. So I presume the state has been mapped. I don't know how good the mapping is, and at some point, you know, if this deep aquifer rises up in Pine County, I guess the other question would be, does the Prairie du Chien or the Franconi, do they go down more in other places too? I mean, in other words, how do we have a map? Do we really know how these things go? It would be fascinating to know.
Representative Clark, one of our final testifiers, has some information about the county atlases, which they do sort of in coordination with DNR. But my answer that I discovered is sort of.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the kind of report that you're looking for, that you're thinking about, that was I was looking at it the other day, and about 1985, 1990, the USGS did a report that included the entire of this stack of aquifers. And that's a published report, and I almost brought it today, that showed water levels at that time in this stack of aquifers. The other reports that, of course, that are being done are the County Atlas reports, which I've worked on directly, that show water levels in individual aquifers in those reports. So there have been basin-wide or very large-scale regional reports that the USGS has done, and there have been county-level, more localized reports that the state and the Minnesota Geological Survey have done that show the relationship of the different aquifers, their position in space, their position in the subsurface, and their connection to one another.
And the folks who spoke from you are talking about three-dimensional stuff, you know, on a statewide basis, which I think is very compelling. Representative Clark.
Well, listen, it might be very interesting if every legislator could just receive a map of what's under our ground in terms of aquifers, so we could start actually relating to them in a meaningful way. I mean, it really would be interesting. I mean, I grew up in Rock County, and I was told, you know, about the aquifer under our well and so on. But I don't think most of us really have a good sense. You know, I didn't, until I looked at this map, know the relationship of these different aquifers here. And I think, you know, if I know that the aquifer that I grew up with, you know, rises up or drops down, or somewhere in the district of one of my other legislators who happens to have, you know, a lot of industrial pollution, or maybe has pristine situation. I mean, it would be really helpful. I don't know. It's just some information I think could be helpful in terms of actually protecting our waters. The more we can relate to these these marvelous, incredible rivers under us, the more we can care about them. I just have one other separate question. So that's a request, I guess, to think about it real fast. I think it was a previous presentations back, there was a bar graph that showed the water that was taken out for agriculture-related irrigation, and then there was non-agricultural irrigation. And I was thinking that that's perhaps the lawns, and I'm not sure what all it was related to.
Plants.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of when we were talking about what's going on in Georgia, some of the single shrimp. I mean, one of the big things that they've done there is just turn people into posses around whether people are watering their grass or not. For a good reason. And so I'm just wondering, what do we know about the non-agricultural related uses? And maybe you're not the right folks to ask, but I was thinking that that does relate to what you're doing in terms of where that water comes from and what's left and what's not there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Park, we do have reported water use for a number of non-crop irrigation, which would include, you know, your lawn watering. You would see that in your municipal water use reports. When you see a hydrograph of municipal water use, you always see a big hump during the June, July, and August. That's why we have that summer surcharge that we applied a couple of years ago to try to encourage conservation there. We also have other types of landscape irrigation-type permits. Golf courses would be some of those. So there's a variety of landscape-type applications, I guess, if that's what you're getting at. We do have some information on that.
The reason I asked, Mr. Chairman, is it was just as high for the non, I thought, I read it right, for the non-agriculture as it was for the agricultural.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
If I recall that graph, the bars were equal, but the water usage for agricultural and non-agricultural were equal, basically equal.
She's suggesting maybe some excessive use of non-agricultural irrigation that might address sustainability.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the lawn irrigation part is not reported separately to the DNR, so we'd have to do a study to look at what that portion of that summer water use might apply to turf, and then compare that to the crop irrigation, which we have very good numbers on.
In the chart that you're talking about, there was a section for municipal use. Municipal water use also includes lawn irrigation, because we're using treated water for lawn irrigation. That's not separated out in that irrigation column. But we can sit down and we have that chart that's probably not with us, but we can come over and show you.
Well, I'm sorry, I was referring to the folks who presented from the LCMR quantifying water balance. That was their chart. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mr. Chair, yeah, it's our data.
Okay.
I mean, our data so we have that information and we'll come over and show you.
Okay.
Great. Moving on, we have a couple other items, pricing, sustainability, regional assessment, and then settle home or come down after that.
If we could go into pricing, Mr. Chair, I have a handout that should be in your packet. It has 5 slides on it. And what this is really kind of a follow-up to Representative Aguinius's interim hearing last month, and then the question came up from that council last month about rates also. And I just want to talk about two types of pricing. One's the pricing for the water use fees, for reporting water use to DNR. Everyone that has a permit with DNR is required to report their water use each year and submit that with a processing fee. And I've got the history in this packet of the water use fees since 1973 when we started out with $5 per permit. And it goes back to 2005 where we added the summer surcharge. So there's a complete history here. If you look at the fee structure for 2003, there's an increasing block rate structure there.
And the question that came up, I believe, that the interim steering related to, you know, how much does this really mean? You know, how much are we paying for water? And so that first slide I have under state water pricing, I try to attempt to answer that question by saying, you know, how many gallons can you get for a penny? So if you look at the minimum water use reporting fee that everybody pays for any amount of water up to 50 million gallons, 1 cent would be 4,950 gallons if you assume that they use 50 million gallons of water. The highest standard rate of $7.50 per million gallons would equate to 1 cent equals 1,333 gallons. If you go to our highest fee schedule, which is for once-through cooling systems, that's $300 per million gallons. That equates to 1 cent per 33 gallons. And then if you look at the summer surcharge that was passed in 2005, that equates to 1 cent per 500 gallons. And that's based on $20 per million gallons. So
would it be fair to say that the extremely high rate on once-through system has been very effective in getting people to not use that, where they just use the water once and get rid of it?
Mr. Chair, that's a matter of the energy pricing at this point. I think that they just look at the numbers and see which one makes more sense,
okay,
quite frankly.
And Mr. Chairman, actually, what eliminates the once-through cooling is the prohibition. They were more than willing to pay that additional cost. They could have kept this system.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, moving on to the next slide, I want to talk about municipal water prices, because they're really the only systems that actually charges for water. And they don't actually charge for water. The water is free. What they're charging for is the service of providing that water. And AWWA has a three-day course, and they have manuals on determining the cost of service for these rates. And it's a fairly intensive process for determining what your costs of service are for each customer category. We don't have any sort of public utility commission that establishes these rates. These are established by the city council or utility board. And if you get your water bill, there's typically a couple types of rates there. You've got your base rate, which is pays typically for capital costs of the system. It can range from $1 to, I just saw one this morning, it was $30 base rate on their water bill. Sometimes you bury a volume of water under that base rate up to, say, 15,000 gallons per pace or quarter. I know that my city used to have that. But that's really allocated towards capital improvements. If you're a system that's been built out, you may have a lower fee. If you're a new system, you may have a higher fee. Finance directors tend to like to have a higher fee here because then they know how much revenue is coming in. And otherwise, you're relying on what the next charge is, which is the volume charge. And the volume charge is what it sounds like. It's just you pay based on that unit of volume. The unit of volumes are typically in units of 1,000-gallon units or 100 cubic feet, which is about 750 gallons. So those are the two most common units that are used. The volume charge is typically for operation and maintenance types of costs, you know, your chemical costs, your labor costs, things like that to provide the service. I put down $1.65 per 1,000 gallons, which was my water rate last spring, just to figure out how many gallons you get for a penny there, and came out with 1 cent for 6 gallons of water. The other thing that you'll see on your water bill is the state testing charge. This is something that's charged by the Department of Health to help defray their cost of water quality testing. It's currently $6.36 a year. If you get your quarterly bill, it'll probably show up as $1.59. In the metropolitan area, Met Council in 2002 looked at some data and came up with an average cost for 10,000 gallons of $19.71. That equals 1 cent for 5 gallons. Just looking at a family of four using 80 gallons per capita per day, you'd be paying about $630 per year, or about 63 cents per day. One of the things that the department does look at when people put in a new well is what type of rate structure they have. Do they have a conservation rate structure? And there's three basic types of rate structures out there. You've got your non-conserving, which is a flat rate. This is typically used by people that do not have water meters. You basically pay a flat rate for an unlimited volume of water since they don't know how much water you're pumping. It's about a meter. You have your declining block rate, where the unit decreases, the unit price decreases as your volume increases. And then you have some base rates that I mentioned before that may be loaded with a high volume of water that may in essence be a flat rate in some situations. Conservation neutral rate structures are typically a uniform rate where, say, you pay a dollar per 1,000 gallons. And then you have your conserving type rate structures, which include the increasing block rate structures, where the unit price increases as the volume increases. And then you have the summer surcharges, where you charge more in the summer to try to get that cost recovery for the additional wells and infrastructure needed to supply that lawn watering water. That's all I have on pricing, if there's any questions.
One observation, and then Representative Wagenius, I want to say that in the Twin Cities metro area, I think that all cities now, except for two, are conserving or conservation neutral in their pricing. Does that sound right? Yeah. In case anyone was wondering. Okay, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I think you answered the question I had because I wasn't, but I think it would be helpful to know specifically, are there any non-conserving pricing units in the state?
Mr. Jeff, I think you're saying that there are, and you're giving a couple of reasons, right?
Correct.
No water meters. Are there any cities with meters? Yeah, I'm curious.
Mr. Chair, Representative Levine, there are a number of systems that do not have meters. I would say it's in the neighborhood of a couple dozen. There are also a number that do have the declining block rate structures. However, those rate structures can really be justified based on the cost of service. If you have some industrial customer that has a uniform demand throughout the year, their cost is less than a residential consumer whose demand goes way up in the summer because of the lawn watering, so they have to have the additional infrastructure that they have to pay for. So they would actually, residential rates may be higher than industrial rates in those situations.
It would be a peak pricing might be involved there with a resident who waters twice a day, every day, let's say, compared to an industrial user has a more predictable volume. Is that what you're...
Correct.
One analogy you might have?
Yes.
Representative Virginia.
Okay. So you have two dozen that are non-conserving and they don't have meters. What about conservation neutral?
Mr. Chair, Representative Virginia, there are a number of those. I mean, that's really a transitioning sort of rate structure that we've said is the minimum that we would like to see out there. We've been getting a lot of people off of the declining block rate structure and moving them towards there. It's kind of a step process. This is what Met Council brought up at the last hearing was. It's a sensitive issue with city councils and utility boards, you know, that are managing those systems for us to try to dictate those types of rates to them. But we are pushing them that direction. We don't shy away from that. If they're looking at putting in a new well, we're saying, you know, what are the alternatives out there? Can we change your rate structure to try to reduce demand rather than putting in a new well to increase your supply for those needs?
But what I would like to have is some numbers here. How many are neutral, and then how many are actually in a conserving mode?
That would be helpful information to have. It's not today, soon, that we could just get an idea of who's doing what.
Mr. Chairman, we can develop that list, and I think we'll put the population on there. Because some of these that have no meters are relatively small. I mean, it's not a major city. But we'll see what we can provide.
Now, that would be helpful. Okay.
Is this just in the metropolitan area, or is this statewide?
Mr. Chair, this is Representative Levine. This is statewide.
Okay. So it would be possible to have numbers and the rate at which folks have switched over to the conserving. And so can I have one more question?
Quite certainly, Representative Wiginius.
Does the conserving model actually conserve?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginius, for instance, with the increasing block rate structures, some of the literature I've seen says that you really need a 25-cent increase between your blocks. So I would say yes, it does. The data on that is hard to get. It's an area that requires more research.
So the demand for water is very, the price demand for water is inelastic, below 25 cents more or less.
Mr. Chair, there's a lot of economists that look at this and talk about elasticity. This is one of those essential goods, though, that, you know, factors into it.
Right. Representative Wiginius.
Okay. What would it take for you to know? You say you need 25 cents. I mean, you think that's what economists think. But you don't know how many municipalities have this? Is that what I... and would take more research? I wasn't sure what you said would take more research.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginius, the actual impact of the rate and how... at the point where people really start saying, this is too much, we need to conserve. Its analogy would be something similar to, you know, filling up at the gas pump.
We don't know that the 25, we don't know that our conserving model works to conserve. Is that basically what's going on here?
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative Wiginius, there's general agreement, I think, that rates do have an impact on water use, along with education and a lot of other incentive type things. But alone, I think that it's not as effective as being done with education.
Because the other testimony was water per capita is growing, and it's growing fairly rapidly. So there's something that's not working to at least level off growth per capita.
And Mr. Jeff, you know, if you're producing information on how many cities are doing certain types of rate structures, if you had a bibliography of some of those economic studies that indicated what that point is where people can serve, that would be helpful too. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wiginius, the one thing I would say is the city of Woodbury has really been proactive and has done a lot of things you're asking about. Specifically, they really put in some disincentives to be a heavy water user for residents. And I think that we could learn from them. I think they've made a couple adjustments, and they've bumped it up even more to where it financially is. Some of these folks, you got to hit them pretty hard before they notch down, which, especially in Woodbury, some of them have heavy clay soils. They shouldn't be watering as often as they are. Anyway, and so I think Woodbury has shown where if we put in some disincentives to water quite so much, and then along with education and, unfortunately, along with enforcement, they've got the water patrol that goes out at night and checks on whatever they're on, odd, even, or every third day schedule and such. But there also are some new things that folks are looking at, some different kind of metering and such that will be even better in the future, because unfortunately a lot of this water that they're using in the municipalities has all been treated and everything, and so it's expensive water, and I think you're right. We need to know and put in those incentives, I would say, to have them conserve and do it. And Woodbury has been on top of that and has notched it up a couple different times. They're a larger community, so it's easier for them to do. And so that's been good to see, because I think it is important that we realize that some folks just believe that in the middle of August their lawn has to be lush green to be the right way, and that's not the truth. And so hopefully between education and you know, I'm sure the DNR is supportive of these kind of things, because it in Woodbury's case, I mean, if you can delay implementation of a new well, I mean, there's huge savings for them. They're drilling these wells only to water the lawn, and that is not right, because I think we know that they could drastically reduce their lawn watering and minimal effect on the viability of their lawn and their trees and stuff.
I know in Shoreview we have a water hog rate at 15,000 gallons a quarter. Then you double it. But in Woodbury there was a great article about people who are very upset that they couldn't water their lawns twice a day, every day in July. And I enjoyed that. I saved the article. It's in there somewhere. Representative Virginia.
Yes. I know you're going to have another hearing and hear from local governments. It would be a good idea to hear from Woodbury, so we would see exactly what Representative McNamara is seeing. So what a proactive community has done might be a good group to hear from. I mean, where we have good models like we had in Dakota County, I think you could feature them when you do a good job.
Great. Representative Clark, and then we'll need to move along here a little bit.
Look, as you were talking about, you know, saving water, one of the things I know that we talked about in our housing committee a couple of years ago is the incredible waste of water that happens in housing with leaks, you know, faucets that don't turn off very well, and all these other kind of things. And so it just seems to me like these might be some connections that we should ask some of our agencies to work with on each other, not only cost the individuals, whether they're the homeowner or the landlord, you know, millions of dollars according to what we spent this money on, but it really wastes water. So, I don't know, just some interaction between these agencies might be interesting.
I was interested in, I should talk to you about health issues, because at my children's elementary school, they shut off water to the rooms because they used them so seldom that the lead and other stuff was just lobbing there, so they stopped using it. But lots of internet connections here. All right.
If I could respond to the quick one, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, there was a great program that the City of St. Paul, or St. Paul Regional Water Utility, and the plumbers in the area got together, and they actually went out and gathered together for breakfast and then went out and fixed leaks and things for elderly residents and things like that. So some of that is going on.
Thank you. I know it's very expensive. I just was looking into changing some faucets in my own house. It's really expensive, both for the actual faucets and then the installation. So I'm glad they're doing it. Maybe we need to think about that in the housing committee.
Very good. What have we left?
Mr. Chairman, you also have sustainability as the general topic. We can real quickly cover some of that. I don't want to have enough time for the MPS, and we can include any of our applicants that come along with that. It's up to you how you wish to proceed.
Why don't you hit us on sustainability, and then we'll have Mr. Sederholm come down.
We can be quick, depending on the number of questions, of course. In your packet, you have this document, and this is on our webpage, and it's more, you can find it on the water's homepage, even. And this just lists a lot of resources that people haven't gone to that and poke around, but they should. The bottom topic, our link on that, the statement of issues and needs, is this report. And this is a very good report that we did based on legislative direction several years ago. And I think it, I encourage everybody to look at that in with some detail. Towards the end of that that report, we identified the changes needed: technical needs, planning needs, monitoring needs, regulatory needs. So there are some recommendations in this report to deal with sustainability. I know there's an issue on how we define sustainability, and this report was specifically to address that. And we had lots of discussions with the other agencies coming up with a definition of sustainable use. And our definition of sustainable use has the term without unacceptable social, economic, or environmental consequences. And I know there's been some concern raised about that. There are you know, there are impacts with any use. I mean, if you take some water out of the ground, there's less water there. So there are impacts. And what the management scheme is to determine how much of that is acceptable. Because there are social needs for the water, there are industrial needs, and how do we balance all of those? So that's what this report gets to, and I would encourage people to take a good look at that, and we can address specific questions later. The other thing that we have, and we thought it would be beneficial to show, and Jeanette Lee is here to provide specific detail on this, if necessary. These are hydrographs that show the actual water level. There we go. And these show the actual water levels. This is in this is a Ramsey County well, so you can show over time from January of 93 up through current how the water levels in this well have reacted over time. And you typically see a seasonal drawdown based on summer pumping. This is also a Ramsey County well, and it shows actually an increase over time with your seasonal drawdown. I'm not sure this big drawdown in 01, is there an explanation for that?
There's not that I know of. I'm Jeanette Lee. Supervise the staff who work on hydrogeology and groundwater in the Division of Water.
So we have 750 observation wells across the state, and there's just kind of, not various lengths of time of data is available, but this is the type of data that's available across the state. So this is another observation well for Ramsey County. These all were in the Jordan Aquifer. This is in the southwestern corner, southeastern corner.
Mr. Chairman, I have provided this particular hydrograph because it's on the edge of Ramsey County, near perhaps Woodbury, and we're seeing those impacts of the summer increases in pumping, which of course caused summer decreases in water level.
The next here is the Dudley Aquifer that's out by Marshall, and this is an aquifer where you've seen the this is south of Marshall, and you can just see a decline over time. This is from 88 through current.
What CMSL is that? Something
mean
surface
level.
Mean
sea level.
Mean sea level.
Above mean sea level.
Where's the what elevation is the surface at then in Lyon County? I'm just curious how deep you have to go here.
Mr. Chairman, in this case, I believe the water surface was initially about 25 feet below the ground surface. This is one of those wells where the water level rises in the well bore above the top of the aquifer.
Okay. Thank you.
And then the last one, real quickly, this is the Grand Falls ethanol, project. And you can see on this chart, the yellow on the bottom is the aquifer, and we have thresholds, the red lines, the 25% thresholds where pumping would stop, and the 50% yellow line is where they would have to modify their pumping. On the left hand of this chart is just showing a well. It's finished into the aquifer, and the water level rises up to the 982 plus elevation, and that's what it was when they started pumping. So you see in the middle of this chart, the water level declining based on use, and that's what we predicted. That's why we have these thresholds to modify pumping at a 50% reduction in this column of water on the left side. Once they got to 50%, they'd have to change. What happened then here in January of 07, they switched to surface water. And they're taking water from the Minnesota River, and you see the elevations on the aquifer in this well rebounded because they stopped pumping. And this is a conjunctive use of water that, they have the well there. In fact, if they can't use surface water in the future, they could use the groundwater for a short period while use was restricted from the surface water. So looking at alternative sources like this and having, not putting all your eggs in one basket is wise water management, and they can manage this with using both surface water and groundwater. And real quickly, without getting any detail on sustainability, this is the type of data and the type of information that we have around the state, and we have the various sustainability reports. And we can answer any questions.
Very good. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this particular chart, could you give us a similar explanation about what's going on?
The Lyon County groundwater levels in the Dudley Aquifer.
Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid I don't know your name.
Senator Rommel.
This well is an observation well in the Dudley Aquifer, and the Dudley Aquifer is one of the water supplies for the city of Marshall. This aquifer is of limited extent, and it does not receive recharge directly from the surface. So the recharge is lagged. When you pump a limited aquifer, then you see declining water levels. They have other sources to draw on, so they can manage this resource. And as you can see, it's starting to level out. These decreases are starting to, level out. This water resource is also limited. You can't draw the threshold on this well. The threshold is drawn at the most critical resource that's nearby, which happens to be a wildlife management area to the south of it. So we're watching these levels. It's being managed. We don't have a threshold to draw on this particular chart, but there is one, and this is a management with another resource.
And to look at this in contrast to the report that you saw last time, if it was at Lyon County, it would have had 1% or 5% of the water was being used. Where, and I think even in that report by John Wells presented last time, very specifically said you have to be site specific. And that was a very general report. And just looking at that, you could reach the wrong conclusion.
Representative Wagenius.
So we're not reaching wrong conclusions here. The metropolitan area seems to have more of the problems as you move toward the northwest, and we haven't talked about that particular area. And I think we heard in testimony earlier that that's the potential availability. But we heard that Plymouth had 6 wells, and 2 of them they pumped dry or were dry this summer. There is an area going up where the aquifers are no longer useful for them because they just kind of peter out. Is that correct? And are we missing another perspective?
If you look at the map that we have on the overhead, the extensive aquifers varies.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Virginia, the northwest area of the part of the metro is the area where the deeper bedrock aquifers are pinching out and coming up closer to the surface. There's less aquifer available. And in some communities, the wells were originally placed so close to each other that when you pump an extreme amount in an extreme climate conditions such as a drought, the wells mutually interfere with each other. So that might appear to be dry because that particular pump isn't getting any water at this moment, but when the pump turns off or while you're waiting for the pump repairman to come, water levels will come back up. We haven't really pumped any of our aquifers dry. We have lowered water levels at that moment, and they do respond by recovering when we stop them. Extreme pumping.
So what does that mean for a city like Plymouth?
Mm-hmm.
This is Lakeville, not Plymouth. But,
that actually looked like something from the Guggenheim, actually.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I don't have Plymouth water level records with me, but because of Lakeville's recent issues with extreme pumping, we happen to have their observation well traces. The red well that goes where the water levels drop the deepest is in the center of the well field, and the brown water levels are from a well that's 2 miles east of the well field, and then the one where the water levels drop the least are the farthest away from the wells. So you could see that if you tried to pump two wells too close to each other, they'd both be pumping those deep water levels, and they just can't draw that much water in that period of time. So if you insist, as that community, of wanting to supply that amount of water in the summer, you're going to have to be drilling more wells and commit to those extra infrastructure costs. You can reduce these summer peaks or space your wells out very far. You can save a lot of money. Because when these water levels are this low, it costs you more money to pump a certain gallon of water. So there's multiple reasons for wanting to reduce your use, because your incremental costs are rising in these situations.
I think my question is a little realistic, and it's over time, and over what time, if the water level reducing in that area, does it make charging as fast as we're taking it out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, you'll notice at the top that the water levels are always coming back to about the same level. That's our indication that overall we're not causing a long-term water level decline. What we're dealing with here with the city of Lakeville are how the wells are actually constructed. It's not the groundwater resource that's the real problem at this moment.
At this moment, I'm not really trying to focus on the short term, but 25 years, 50 years. Are you confident about the moment?
Mr.
About that many years away as you are about the moment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, that gets really into that land use connection and how we develop the area, and that's one of the issues that we're working with the Metropolitan Council on in developing that master water supply plan. So that is the focus of our work there. So we'll be exactly at that issue.
Okay, can we move to the county atlas? Did you have a laptop?
It's
not convenient,
yeah. Mr. Chair.
Thank
you. As we're making this transition here, I'm just looking at this Granite Falls energy threshold chart that we were just making reference to, and it just surprises me how quickly, you know, the threshold was at 60% within just over a year, and then a year later, it, you know, was not back to the recharge level it started at. And so I think, you know, this just kind of shows how fast some of these issues can come about, and that, you know, the importance of monitoring them through the years.
I agree. All right. Could you state your name and your organization for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dale Setterholm. I'm the Associate Director of the Minnesota Geological Survey.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Fire away. This is the blank slate slide.
Yeah, it's,
there you go.
I can either see it there or I can see it here, but not.
Oh, okay.
So I'll leave it there. That'll be just fine. I hope I've prepared for what you wanted to hear from me. I know you wanted to hear about the County Atlas program, and I kind of just put that into context so that it doesn't stand alone, but why do we do it, and where do we do it, and what does it cost, and how might we continue in the future, that kind of thing. As a framework for water resource management, the basic steps are to collect and compile and analyze and interpret geologic and hydrologic data, and then use that information somehow to estimate what the resource is, what its characteristics are, how we might make use of it. And then we also need to continue to monitor the system after those decisions are made to see how good we were at figuring out how things work. So that's the broad concept. The information we need to do that begins with geologic mapping, and that's what my organization does. In this program, we're talking about comprehensive geologic mapping at 1 to 100,000 scale. We do a county at a time, and that scale is appropriate for most of the uses that we're seeing out there. By comprehensive, I mean we look at the geology at the land surface, we look at the complete thickness of the glacial deposits, and we look at the bedrock as well, and try to recognize where the water resources lie within that, how they're connected to the land surface, and how they're connected to each other. So what we're really trying to map is the extent and the boundaries of the aquifers, the kind of material that separates them from each other and from the land surface. We go as far as not just drawing these things in two dimensions, but creating digital elevation models of the surfaces between these units, and I'll mention later why those are important. And one of the other most important products of the county atlas is we look at all the well records for all the wells we can find in the county, and we identify which aquifer each one is taking water from. It's kind of a circular thing. We use the wells to define the aquifer, and then identify the well as a user of that aquifer. So we have an understanding of the distribution of the demand on the groundwater system there. The work that we do at the Geological Survey then is followed by our partners in the Division of Waters at DNR. They specifically do hydrologic mapping and analysis, and their work necessarily follows ours as a stepwise progression. They look at water levels in the aquifers and map out those levels so that we can detect the direction of flow of water within the system. They look at the water chemistry and age. We understand the rates of flow. Sensitivity, specifically identifying those parts of the land surface where contaminants could travel from the land to the aquifer in a relatively rapid way. Other data that's collected either by DNR or others includes stream gauging, which is an indication of the discharge of groundwater from the system. Rivers don't dry up when it stops raining. There's a discharge from the groundwater system to the rivers. And their work also highlights the interaction of surface water bodies and aquifers. That's particularly important in Minnesota, where we value our surface water bodies greatly. It's probably also true that if we get to a point where we are depleting aquifers or drawing them down, it may be that the first places we become aware of that is in changes to our surface water bodies. It's not always going to be the case, but it is a likelihood. This diagram was put together to explain some aspects of the program for a specific proposal, but it shows the kinds of activities beginning at the bottom of the pyramid. There are very basic data gathering activities that we do at the Geological Survey, including verifying the locations of wells, doing test drilling, and putting together the databases. That's followed by field mapping, mapping the subsurface, which is more of an off-the-base activity, other kinds of data collection, and then finally we bring it all together, both in published form and in geographic information systems, and try to set it up so even non-geologists can make efficient use of the work that we've done. That was a lesson that we learned somewhat slowly, but we figured finally that there weren't very many geologists to look at our maps. There was a whole lot more people who aren't geologists, and so we've tried very hard to make them usable by maximum number of people. That part A, part of the atlases, typically takes 3 years or perhaps a little longer depending on rate of funding and complexity and things like that. The two blue layers of the pyramid are the work done then by DNR Waters. That typically takes 2 or more years. So start to finish, a Tony Atlas can take 5 or more years. It's always possible to work faster with more people, but there are actually some good reasons for working at this pace. For one thing, field work in Minnesota is not done well in the winter months when there's snow and ice and so forth. So having a couple of field seasons and then being able to bring all the data together after that works well. Having accomplished all the things that a geologic atlas does and putting it in the hands of people who can use it, there are a variety of users. There are local users, well drillers, counties, and the state agencies and even federal agencies make use of that. And if I understand what you're trying to accomplish, you want to know something about how this will help us make decisions about water allocation and management. What I've listed here are just some examples of things that might be done based on an atlas. The first is a computer simulation or a groundwater model. And all of the data that the Geological Survey and the DNR put together in these atlases is then entered into a numerical simulation of the system so that when a well is proposed or you're contemplating the effects of climate change, you can vary those things in the model, run the model, and see what the outcome is. Do the aquifers start to become depleted or recharge adequate to keep them up? It's just a method of doing that. And I list the USGS there, the local Mountain View office, as a group that does that kind of work and has done that kind of work in Minnesota. There are certainly others as well. And it's done on various scales, just for a specific use or perhaps on a regional scale. And certainly you are aware of other methods that have been proposed and in some cases tried for estimating what sustainable yield may be. I'm not an expert on those methods. I can't advocate for any of them. My point here is that they are not likely to work well if we don't do that county atlas work ahead of time. Certainly everything we do there will improve the predictive ability of those other methods and make them work better. Having done that, having done analysis and made decisions about allocation of water, I think it's important to realize that the job is not done. Those methods are not foolproof. And furthermore, the conditions that affect the groundwater system are not static. Climate can change, demand can change, all of those things. And so we need to monitor our aquifers forever. And again, my point is that the geologic atlases and the work that's done in them makes that monitoring activity more efficient and more accurate and done in a better way. You can imagine we could have a monitoring well in an aquifer, say somewhere in Ramsey County, and we start to see it go down. The first thing we're going to want to know is who else is using water from that aquifer. If we haven't defined the boundaries of the aquifer, if we haven't tied the wells to specific aquifers, we wouldn't be able to answer that question about cause and effect. So that's an important part of the picture. This figure was put together to show the progress we've made in the last 25 years in the Atlas program. Specifically, the green parts represent atlases that are either complete or are currently underway. I think we've got 16 done and 6 underway. I think it's important to note then that some of those atlases are 25 years old and they're not as good as the ones we did last year. Completely different technology, And so in some cases it's necessary to go back and do an update on the ones that we've already done. Scott County was an example of that. It was completed back in 82. And it was, all the maps were drawn on the basis of about 1,200 water wells that we had information for in that county. We went back 2 years ago and redid it, and there were 6,000 water wells that we could use to draw those lines. So much higher resolution. And then again, we apply new technology so that the information is much more usable and applicable to many different problems. This map sets out a set of priorities, and I am reticent to do that because if anybody wants an atlas, I want to give them one, even if they aren't particularly my priority. My point is just that this is by no means rigid. What we've laid out is the yellow ones as being some of the most important ones, and we're doing that on the basis of population growth. Certainly up the I-94 corridor, you can see there are yellow counties that do not have atlases, and certainly we'll need them to address growing water demand. We also look at where the water resources are particularly sensitive and try to make sure that we cover those areas. Even though we've only covered 16 of the 87 counties, we have served almost 60% of the population of Minnesota. And so that is an outcome of going where the people are first. Future work, as I said, would go into those areas where we see growth. It's also much more efficient for us to build out from existing work rather than jump out into the wilderness, per se, and start from scratch. I would also say that it's the goal of the Minnesota Geological Survey to provide this kind of mapping everywhere in the state of Minnesota, so those white areas in the north. This may not be the appropriate program, or it may be at some point, but there are other vehicles by which we can achieve this mapping, and that's certainly our intent. My director comes from Winnipeg, and he would like to see more color there in the northern part of the state. But as I said, this is not set in stone. This is just kind of an indication to you of where we might go in the future. As far as how long it takes to do these things, so the in-progress areas will be complete in about 2013. If we wanted to do the 9 counties that are listed there as A priority, that could take us out to about 2020, depending on funding rates and progress. There's numbers there for the current funding that goes into this program, and I'll leave that to DNR to explain as it doesn't come directly to me. I think that's all I'll say about that. Move along. This is some statistics for the specific parts of the Atlas program. The average cost per county for the Part A that the Geological Survey does is about $330,000. And then for the Part B that DNR Waters does, it's about an additional $250,000 per county. So that's a grand total of $580,000 per county. Those are, of course, today's costs. And currently, it takes, as I said, about 3 years to complete a county, but we work on 3 to 5 projects simultaneously. So our production rate is about 1 county per year on a continuous basis.
So you'll be alive when you finish?
I hope I won't still be working, at least. I'd like to be alive, but if we apply those costs to the 9 high-priority areas we've identified, we come up with a number of slightly over $5 million. To do the 15 additional that were the second tier of priority, that's another almost $9 million. I've got average annual costs there at MGS of $700,000 and less than $400,000 at DNR. That's for an accelerated rate of production, which I'll show in the next slide. That would leave you at about $1 million a year to accelerate this program. And as I said, it's probably also wise to update some of the existing atlases. The schedule that I put together, the blue bars there are atlases that are currently underway. Actually, one of them is finished. The two green ones are Chisago and Benton County, which are being done with LCCMR funds, a grant that I got last year. That funding is only 2 years long, and the projects are probably 3 years long, but that's the allowed us to get started on those. The yellow bars represent three counties that are associated with a current LCCMR proposal down in the Blue Earth, Le Sueur, and Nicollet County area that tentatively has been approved, and we hope we will get to work on those very soon. And what I've laid out there then is MGS working on at least three to six projects concurrently. That would bring our production rate up to about an atlas every 18 months. Three atlases every 18 months, so about double the rate of production that we're at right now. That will, of course, depend on funding. What I know about funding right now is that I'll receive $200,000 a year from DNR Waters for this year and next. I'll get another $200,000 from the LCCMR project each year. And then the numbers in blue are for that tentative LCCMR project, which would increase my total. But nothing is known about funding beyond those projects. So that's, I just want everyone to be aware that that's, you know, where we're at right now. So at this point, I can answer any questions you'd like. I also have, I didn't intend to present the atlases and show what they look like, but I certainly have one here on the laptop, and I could do that if that would be helpful.
Any questions? It's a daunting task. I know you and I have talked several times, but I think it's definitely necessary. I think we may be watered out today here. Thanks very much for coming around, and we never did get our quorum at the right place at the right time. I'll just wait until the next one, but any other questions or comments, concerns for next meeting? Yes, Representative Clark.
I just have a question. I remember when we were hearing from another presenter that the USGS would have some money that was available, and that's how they did some of the water mapping projects. Does that include, how is that related to the Minnesota Geologic Service to the USGS in terms of these resources?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Thurman,
Representative Clark, there's no exchange of money between us. What typically happens is we do an atlas, and then they use that data to input into their project to do the things that they do. So there's a building on the data, but there is no contractual relationship or funding relationship.
And you are part of the University of Minnesota, that's correct.
Right.
Not a state agency,
right.
Well, quasi-state agency. They have a really cool bookstore in the basement, I'll tell you. So if you want to have a map, if there is one, you can find it. Representative Wiggins.
I'll just make a comment. I mean, this is a critical work for Minnesota, no question about it. And one thing that happened a little bit differently in LCCMR this year, and one never knows when a decision is made whether it will carry forward, but that this was considered base data, and for LCCMR base data, like biological surveys, just constantly funded. I mean, not constantly, just always on the radar screen. And hopefully this is now always on the radar screen because it's so fundamental.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagini,
the role.
It strikes me as odd that after 25 years, we're still funding this work on a temporary basis. This work is the most fundamental reason to have a geological survey, but for one reason or another, it was never made part of the base funding in the organization. And I know that the university plays a role in that. And I spoke with the dean's assistant this morning about that very thing. And I'm sure that we could be more efficient and more productive if that change was made at some point, but it will take some time.
Representative Virginius.
Well, you know, the university is doing our statewide plan right now for conservation, and I hope this, and I haven't asked, but will ask, is this part of the statewide plan?
I think that would be helpful.
I don't know if there's anybody from LCCMR here, but we'll make sure that question's asked.
Very good. With that, hearing your other questions, comments, concerns, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.